Welcome to Go West Young Podcast, the show about the outdoors and your public lands. My name is Aaron Weiss at the Center for Western Priorities in Denver, Colorado, joined this week by our Executive Director, Jen Rokola.
Hello.
Later on, we will look back at the best bargain in American history, 2 cents an acre. It happened 150 years ago this week. Now, normally on the show, we start with a look at what's making news in our parks and public lands, but that is all we're going to talk about this week because our guest is the ranking member of the House Natural Resources Committee. He is a longtime advocate for the environment, public lands, and Native American tribes. He's been a member of Congress since 2003, representing Tucson and Southern Arizona. Congressman Raul Grijalva, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you very much, and very kind of you to invite me on, and I'll be flying back to my neck of the woods, Tucson, later today, and looking forward both to the good Sonoran heat and the opportunity to visit and to be with some of the constituents. But it'll be a good day.
It's my hometown, too, so you're making me feel homesick right now. I want to start with President Trump's actions this week, rolling back climate protections. Do you think, given the other legislative failures, that is this going to be the legacy of the Trump administration?
Well, you know, they seem to be pivoting. Every time they get into a mess, whether it's the conflict issue, the collusion issue around Russia and Putin, or whether it's the conflict issue among their staff in general, whether it is the abject failure of them not knowing how to replace after all they screamed about was to repeal the Affordable Care Act, and you can name the Muslim ban, permanent injunction now till a court hearing. That was ruled, and there's variety of other issues that keep going on, which kind of shows how unhinged the administration is to begin with. But every time these things happen, they pivot to the environment, they pivot to the issue of immigration, and then kind of throw out on the environment issue this red meat, saying, you know, it's all these regulations, it's all this public land that is in the way of real economic progress and jobs and energy independence, which have, you know, if once one were to apply science and fact to this debate, they would have been debunked and have been debunked for decades. Those protections, the environmental, the Endangered Species Act, NEPA, Clean Air, Clean Water, those have never been the impediments to economic growth that now they're using as their rationale for trying to undo them, weaken them, and in some instances completely eliminate. Our federal agencies need to plan for climate change. We need to be, as a government, a national government, in the lead on that. And the president is preventing his own agencies from taking it seriously, scrubbing discussions about climate change in various departments from their internet services and websites, and basically, you even have the head of EPA questioning the science. So you have deniers in charge of the critical issue of climate change, and you know which direction it's going to go. The ending of the coal leasing moratorium doesn't anybody any good. You know, they can talk about bringing back coal, the rebirth of coal, jobs, but the fact of the matter is, for my Republican colleagues and more conservative members of this House, that this is a free market phenomenon that's occurring. The coal industry is going down and will continue to go down because they cannot compete with a much cheaper source of energy, which is natural gas. That is just the marketplace ruling. You have big utility companies across this country converting to natural gas because they see it as cost effective and increasing their bottom line as well. So I think that order hurts human health. It hurts our environment, both of those, and it sends a message that this administration and friends in Washington will probably go after any standard and possibly take any step that they think is going to further what I think is an industry agenda around our public lands. No longer are we talking about our public land as a multi-use asset that American people have, but as a commodity. What can we get out of it? How quickly can we get it out? And so conservation, preservation, recreating, public use become secondary to the industrial mission, which is extraction, and what can we get out of this commodity. It's two ways to look at our public land. It's a wonderful legacy that should be there for generations, or as a commodity to take as much as you can out of it and reap what you can in terms of profits, and then you leave. And I think that, unfortunately, that that philosophy is kind of seems to be the one that's in use right now, at least with this administration and with departments.
Congressman Grijalva, thank you for joining us today. Speaking of public lands, we'd like to turn to national monuments. You put out a challenge this week to Rob Bishop, the chairman of the Natural Resources Committee, basically daring him to propose and debate a bill on the Antiquities Act. Can you tell us what's going on there?
Yeah, I think the last session, there was 22 bills filed about the Antiquities Act. Everything from eliminating the act as a whole, curtailing it, limited it to 5,000 acres, allowing veto power on the part of states and counties over any designation a president would make. And the reason that I brought that up is that the Antiquities Act and the use by the presidents, all presidents, Republican or Democrat, has been as a consequence of the legislative process not producing the protections that certain special places in this country need. Federal, and it's all federal land. We're not talking about designating private land as a monument. These are all federal lands that now you put another layer of protection on those lands. And presidents use that authority. They've used it consistently. Teddy Roosevelt in the Grand Canyon did it at an appropriate time. Otherwise, what we consider now an icon would not be in the shape that it's in right now. And I think that do you have a bill? What do you want to do with it? Because I really think that they're on shaky legal ground on this designation. We've also asked Secretary Zinke to tell us legally where this would stand in terms of any challenge, either legislatively or by executive order trying to undo what has already been done by a previous president. And it's a dare in the sense that I believe I know the American public supports these designations. Even people within their own states, like Utah, support the designations. And so, rather than kill us, not be upfront and deal with it, let's have this debate. And I think by having this debate, we can clarify the fact that it is something the American people support, the designations. And second of all, that there is tenuous legal ground in which to challenge it.
So one of the things we've noticed here as we track Congressman Bishop and what he tries to do on the Natural Resources Committee is that he talks a really big game, but at the end of the day, he doesn't seem to be terribly effective at actually passing bills. I mean, we had the Utah Public Lands Initiative last year, which had the support of the entire Utah delegation. It got out of committee and died right after that. Is that, in your mind, I mean, a good thing? Would your life be worse if he was more effective at actually passing some of the bad bills he has?
That was a roundabout question, but it was a good one. I think that I don't want to. One of the things that I go into this is not underestimating Mr. Bishop, in this case, an opponent on these issues. So I don't underestimate him. But the fact that, you know, these broad, sweeping, let's get rid of this particular law, just don't have the popular support. You know, Chavez tried, and he was on another piece of legislation to give lands back to the states, and he was overwhelmed by opposition and pulled the legislation. And so I think even within the Republican caucus, they know that they are stepping into a potential political quagmire, taking on this kind of extremist position that Bishop wants to push him in, and in doing so, at great political risk. So I think the calculations are not that he doesn't want to do it. The calculation, I think the leadership within his own caucus understand the public sentiment is not going to be on their side, and that's maybe a fight they don't want.
So Congressman Grijalva, I know if you're watching cable news, they focus a lot on kind of the partisan divide in Washington. Are there any issues where you think that you can work with Congressman Bishop and the folks on the other side of the aisle? Are there any issues where you can find common ground?
I would hope so, but these fights over endangered species, these fights over the Antiquities Act, these fights over NEPA, these fights over public access issues, these fights about habitat protection, about the permitting process for extraction, about the value of having a robust and fully staffed Interior Department that can do the job not only for the public, but even for the industries they purport to be supporting. Those will and have been embittered. Are there areas in which we should be looking at? We should be looking at the bad backlog of maintenance needs that our public lands have, everything from sewer treatment issues to the refurbishing of trails, to the amenities that visitors need, to additional protection around watershed areas, making road construction less polluting. The list goes on, and so I think that we should be able to work on backlog. We should be able to come up as everybody's talking about an infrastructure bill. What are the backlog needs that we have that are in the billions and billions of dollars in the rear, and to bring certainly during the centennial period of our public lands, I think we should be able to work on that. Those are nuts and bolts, to some extent, brick and mortar, to some extent, conservation initiatives and protection initiatives within our public lands that we should all be able to come to some consensus about and come to consensus about an amount of money we could start working with. So that's one area. The other area I would hope, is the other area of jurisdiction and trust responsibility that we have with our native tribes and native people, that we should be able to objectively deal with the healthcare crisis on the reservation and among Native Americans, that we should be able to protect their prerogatives in terms of laws like antiquities, like sacred sites, like sovereignty, like cultural resource preservation, and historical preservation, to be able to work with tribes to define and to have a real consultation process with them, with federal agencies. I think those are middle ground positions we should be able to work on. So if you're asking two pretty obvious ones to me, those are two that if we should be able to work together. But I have to preface that by what I said earlier. These other battles are going to be embittered, and we have on our side of the aisle, at least on the Resources Committee, a solemn responsibility to defend these public lands, and we're going to do that. Now, I think sometimes that debate and that struggle unfortunately begins to taint with the majority any possibility to work on, let's say, the two things I just mentioned to you.
On tribal sovereignty, we heard Secretary Zinke during his confirmation hearings talk about sovereignty needs to mean something. On the other hand, you've got things like giving the go-ahead to the Dakota Access Pipeline. Do you think Secretary Zinke was all talk on that, or have you seen him take any actions that lead you to believe he is taking tribal sovereignty seriously?
I hope not. I hope that that was an earnest and a truthful expression of how he wants to deal with Indian country. Because, you know, in the last decade in particular, you know, the issue of sovereignty is being redefined. And you saw it in Dakota. You saw it the Standing Rock Sioux and how they extended their issue of sovereignty and the government's need to conduct its trust responsibility with them in consultation over that very, very important pipeline issue. Oak Flats, sacred site to the San Carlos Apache, endangered by a land trade for a mining operation. So, and you can keep going across the country. So the strongest proponents for protecting the Antiquities Act, tribes. Unanimous resolutions to make Bears Ears in the Grand Canyon monuments they presented to the president. And great supporters of Endangered Species Act. And in fact, one of the leading proponents for the protection of the grizzly. So the list goes on. So I think if the secretary is sincere in him wanting to address the sovereignty issue and mean something, I think he'll quickly come to the conclusion that the overlap in jurisdictions that he has also affect that sovereignty question, and that Native nations are coming in with a more evolved definition of what sovereignty is and what their right to consultation and input and stakeholder status is. I think that's changed a lot, and we'll see how he deals with that change.
Congressman, you've been a leader on the Land and Water Conservation Fund, something that does have a lot of bipartisan support. Congressman Bishop is so opposed to it, though, is there a strategy that gets LWCF to a permanent renewal?
Well, we filed the legislation, the same one we have, to make it permanent, to protect its revenue stream so it's not used for maintenance backlog in the public lands. That should not be used for that, and for other budgetary expenses within Interior, including wildfire suppression, that justifiably need to come from the federal budget and be added to the Interior's budget and not taken away from the Land and Water Conservation Fund. And that was part of the debate with Bishop. He wanted to basically take resources from it. I think that is a bipartisan. We're going to file the bill, and then we're going to come to the consideration of whether or not we think we have enough support to be able to have a discharge petition. That means it goes on the floor. If 216 members sign it, then we have to have a vote on it, regardless of what the committee did or didn't do with it. If we don't have any indication, I don't think having a hearing and trying to move it through regular order here, then that becomes an option that I think we're going to use.
And do you think you might be able to get to 216 for a discharge petition?
When we circulated the last time, we had a huge number of you know, mostly Democrats, but there was a significant number in the 20s of Republicans that also signed on. And that same network that helped us get those signatures is still available, and now it becomes a different... You know, a discharge petition is more difficult because, you know, you're really going against your party by going and signing it. But if we have no other option, at least to highlight that this is something that needs to be done, that is when I do have my meeting with the secretary. That is a topic of great that we're going to have as a list of one of the priorities. And it is certainly one of the priorities that we've asked Chairman Bishop to schedule for a hearing.
What's the takeaway to all of this for those of us who aren't in D.C.? You wrote a piece in High Country News last month talking about the power of protest and the Chaffetz bill that you mentioned that would have sold off 3 million acres. Are the protests working?
Well, I think it's also, one of the things we need to do that I think is so critical, that you, the people that participate in your podcast, listen to your program, that need to understand that public opinion is a huge ingredient and how decisions are made in Washington, D.C. You saw that with the Affordable Care Act and its repeal, that public opinion had an impact. And if all consistently support for endangered species, support for our public lands, support for clean air, clean water, support for the Antiquities Act, and support for Land and Water Conservation Fund, name the legislation, and many of these significantly signed by Richard M. Nixon, a Republican. The point I'm making is that I think, and that's a little bit of necessary self-criticism in terms of my party. We need to raise the profile of these conservation, environment, public lands issues so they're not back burner issues, so that the public understands what's at stake. And the more awareness is created around, let's say, the Land and Water Conservation, the better our opportunity to keep the worst from happening or to getting something positive done. And so our whole effort as part of our job in this committee is to do that, raise the profile and create a bigger level of public engagement in what's going on with these issues. When I got the ranking member position, one of the first things we created was the Office of Public Engagement to get the message out, to bring diverse constituencies to play on these issues, and to be part of the stakeholders on these issues, and we're going to continue to do that. But, you know, if our political leadership, at least in a partisan way, Democrats, as we battle through a lot of these debates we're going to have with this administration and with this Republican-controlled Congress, raising the profile and the awareness of public land issues, conservation issues, preservation issues, and what they mean to America's legacy, I think it only helps us. And that's part of the effort that needs to be done as well.
When you're taking into account constituent input, what forms of communication work best? Should people be calling, emailing, sending postcards? What breaks through the noise?
I think something written. If you're going to write something written, I think the district offices as a point of contact for constituents, not necessarily writing to D.C., has a huge impact. You know, if I have, for instance, if I have 30 people coming to into my office to complain about a vote I've taken, you know, that's the multiplier effect of plenty. And so you need to deal with it, and you have to sit down with these individuals and figure out what you did right and what you did wrong, and at least have a honest explanation or discussion with them. So to me, the contact with that district office of that member of Congress is vital, because that's the first input that a congressman who's feeling the pulse of his constituents is going to go to. Our office responds to anybody that takes the time to write us something down. We respond to the emails that we get that are from our district. That's priority number one. And I think that's the same with a lot of members of Congress, in that they're going to respond first to that constituency base that elects them or unelects them. And so if I were to put emphasis, that's where the emphasis would be.
I want to change subjects here for a second and talk about Southern Arizona, because it's near and dear to my heart. Your district, one of the most spectacular districts for public lands in the country. Do you have a favorite hike or a favorite destination that you tell folks they have to experience when they come to Southern Arizona?
I love Sahuaro West Park. I think it's just the landscape. The Ironwood Bosque, I think, is spectacular. And the Tumacacuri area going toward Nogales and the border, beautiful. But, you know, the San Pedro and that whole, even though it's not in my district, that whole last surviving flowing waterway that we have to continue to protect from intrusions of development and other things, it, in and of itself, is something special. But I always tell everybody that you know, you can go, you know, and then the Sky Islands that we have all around the basin of Tucson, are great places to go to. And then the wonderful mixture of history, culture, and landscape. I mean, it'll grab you. You'll get into one or the other, and the influences that that peoples have made to that region. They're all over. They're scattered all over this that area. But you know, if I wanted to go either solitude, or I like to tell my staff just to chill, the first two or three areas are the ones I would like to.
Fabulous.
Congressman, the next time I visit Tucson, I've written down the list you just shared with us, and I was actually in Tucson a couple weeks ago and visited Saguaro National Park, but I was on the east side. So
west is nice. I mean, it's the Saguaro strands are beautiful, and you know, right about this time when the desert wildfires are going crazy, it's really nice.
And for those who haven't experienced or know about the San Pedro River, as the congressman mentioned, it's also absolutely amazing to go visit. Anything else you want to add, Congressman?
No, I think this is a generational. We're in this tough historic moment, and so. But you know, I'm an eternal optimist, and I think that we're going to win these. We're going to keep the worst from happening. That's our effort. That's our responsibility, not only as members of Congress, but as people that understand that these public land legacy needs to be around for generations. And this is an imminent threat that we're seeing politically. But because it is a political threat, you know, we're going to concentrate on a political response, because that's what's necessary now. What's at stake is a legacy, a generational legacy, and we can't afford to take a step back on this one.
That's it. Congressman Raul Grijalva represents Arizona's 3rd Congressional District. He's the ranking member of the House Natural Resources Committee. Congressman, thank you so much for your time today.
You guys, I appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Let's wrap up with a look back at this week in Western history. It was 150 years ago this week that Secretary of State William Seward signed a treaty with Russia, agreeing to purchase Alaska for $7 million, just 2 cents an acre. Why such a bargain? Well, back in the late 1850s, Russia's emperor, Alexander II, may have hoped to start a bidding war with the British, which had colonies on the mainland and Vancouver Island. But the Brits weren't really interested, and the U.S. had bigger things going on, like the risk of civil war. It was after the war when everything lined up. Russia needed cash, the Tsar wanted to weaken the British Empire, and President Andrew Johnson wanted a distraction from congressional negotiations over Reconstruction. So, after an all-night negotiating session, the treaty was signed at 4 a.m. on March 30th. The plan was ridiculed in Congress and the papers, earning the nickname Seward's Folly and President Johnson's Polar Bear Garden. But $7 million was a steal, just $123 million in today's money. The treaty barely survived the Senate. It was ratified by just one vote a little over a week later. Alaska, purchased by the United States this week in 1867. This week also saw a turning point in the Montana fur trade, with the first voyage of the steamboat Yellowstone in 1832. It was the vision of John Jacob Astor, America's first multimillionaire. His American Fur Company dominated the northern fur trade from a trading post called Fort Union, where the Yellowstone and Missouri rivers met. That's along what's now the Montana-North Dakota border. Steamboats had only been in regular service for less than 20 years, and none of them traveled the treacherous currents of the Upper Missouri River at the time. So Astor had a boat built specially for the trip to Fort Union, with a high wheelhouse so the pilot had a better view of the river. It left from St. Louis on March 26th and reached Fort Union in June. The Yellowstone, and the fleet of similar steamboats that followed, gave Astor's company a huge advantage over smaller competitors. They relied on man-powered keelboats, much slower and less efficient. Within a few years, Astor's American Fur Company had a virtual monopoly over the northern fur trade, all thanks to a steamboat that dared to navigate the Upper Missouri River this week in 1832. That's it for this episode of Go West Young Podcast. We do love hearing your feedback about the show. Podcast@westernpriorities.org is where to send your praise, complaints, and ideas for future episodes. Along those lines, we have a fascinating diversion coming up in a couple weeks, an interview with author Michael Finkel. His new book is The Stranger in the Woods, based on his interviews with a hermit and prolific burglar who lived in the Maine woods for 27 years, not speaking to anyone the entire time. It's a riveting book. He's a great interview, so hang on for that. On behalf of Jen Rokola and all of us at the Center for Western Priorities, thanks to our guest this week, Raul Grijalva, and thanks to you for listening.